Dodd disliked horses intensely, but they were occasionally necessary here because there were not enough vehicles to go around, and in some places a vehicle couldn't navigate the terrain. In addition to his work to spur immigration from Midwake, China, and Russia, work Kurenami heartily approved, Dodd began a detailed inventory of Eden stores in all the locations so far opened for use. It was inevitable that Kurenami, with his duplicate computer records, would eventually send out parties to check the stores farther from Eden, near the nuclear no man's land surrounding what was once the course of the Mississippi. Then Kurenami would discover construction materials were missing, as were the salt dome stored fuel reserves and weapons. And eventually, Kurenami would discover the location of Dredd. Dodd had to do something to prevent all of that, so he tried to contact Dietrich Zimmer. Almost surprisingly, Zimmer was already in North America, and after several abortive contact attempts, Zimmer got word to Dodd. Dodd borrowed a horse from among the 24 or so the Germans donated for Eden's use, had it saddled, and rode to his meeting with Dietrich Zimmer, about 3 miles from Eden, in a rocky defile in a dry riverbed. Dodd's rear end was stiff and sore. He felt like the insides of his thighs would never be the same. Walking along the rocky defile after tying up his horse was almost a pleasure. He rounded a bend in the path and saw Dietrich Zimmer sitting calmly beside a synth fuel stove, the smell of hot tea on the calm, cool air.
Have some tea, Commander.
Dodd hurried over the rocky ground to Zimmer's side.
You've got to kill Kurenami for me before he keeps us from getting control of Dredd.
Defense Recovery Emergency Arm Deterrent. Dredd. What a picturesque name. But even if your nemesis Kurenami locates it, he will be unable to deprive you of it. I have not been idle, you see. While you are unable to reach me, I have located the missiles you so desperately want, Commander, and buried them where no one can find them unless I wish them found.
Dodd dropped to one knee beside the stove, looking Zimmer straight in the eye.
You cheated me? You cheated me, damn you!
Dietrich Zimmer sat, oddly quiet.
Say something!
What is it that you wish me to say, Commander?
I need those nuclear warheads or...
Your plans will be jeopardized. But you see, I have greater plans. And you have a single choice. You will cooperate with my plans, or you will never leave here.
You?
What?
Zimmer smiled.
Your plan?
Why risk annihilation because of impatience when... If all the circumstances are perfect, victory will be assured.
Dodd just looked at Zimmer.
I wish to hold the world in thrall to National Socialism. You merely wish to establish yourself as a dictator. If you cooperate with me, you will have your power and I will have my new world. If you do not cooperate, you will die.
Dodd could see no one else. There was no sign of a plane or vehicle or even a horse. He could kill Zimmer, perhaps, because Zimmer had only a handgun in view, and it was holstered. Dodd looked at Zimmer's blue eyes, and the eyes still held laughter, as if somehow Zimmer knew what he was thinking and found it humorous, amusing. Dodd realized that his hand had been moving toward his belt and he froze.
What do you mean?
Great plans require great leaders to bring them to fruition, Commander. If you follow my plan, your troublesome Akira Kurenami will be dead, and you will be forever rid of the Yellow Man and his Black Wife. You will control Eden, bring Eden to a position of great power, living out your life in happiness and comfort. But you must do only what I say to do, and only when I say.
I don't understand, Zimmer.
There is no reason to suppose that you should. Suffice it to say, were I to have your yellow nemesis Kurenami killed while members of the Rock family live, you would never know rest until you yourself are dead. If the Rock family is out of the way, however, you will be able to function with impunity in the aftermath of Kurenami's death, because there will be no one to stop you. Provided, of course, Kurenami's death cannot be so obviously linked to you that New Germany or Midwake unilaterally intervenes. What remains, then, is to remove the Rock family.
Kill them? Yes, but how?
Killing them would be problematic at best, Commander. They will take themselves out of the picture, as it were, and then we can kill them.
I don't follow you at all.
Tea.
Simmer poured a cup of steaming dark brown liquid for himself.
No.
Simmer shrugged his shoulders.
How will you get rid of them without killing them?
By using their sense of family against them. They have a quest, do they not? To see me dead for what I did to John and Sarah Rourke and for killing the child. And they wish to see you dead, or punished at least. If I am dead and you are dead, they will do the inevitable.
Dead?
No one is talking about killing you, Commander, unless you choose to disobey me. No, I wish for us to appear to be dead. Then you will be able to go on with your work, and I with mine.
You aren't making any sense.
My medical specialty is microsurgery, but I always considered myself a devotee of motivational psychology. I perfected a computer model which predicts, with a degree of certainty in which I have full confidence, just what the Rock family will do when they realize their quest is at an end. They will join John and Sarah Rock in cryogenic sleep. It may be immediate, it may take as long as 18 months, according to the model's most extrapolated predictions, but sleep they will.
Why?
Simmer lit a cigarette.
Their very sense of family will undo them. If my model is wrong, I will still be able to destroy them.
You mean if they don't go into cryogenic sleep, you will still have a way?
Yes, a perfect way. And the model allows for all or any of them not to take the cryogenic sleep. In either event, they will die.
But what about...
Dodd was uncertain about this business of appearing to be dead himself.
There will be an incident. Never mind what. Two bodies will be substituted for our own. I have already prepared my duplicate, a captured soldier of New Germany. Your duplicate will be ready soon.
Duplicate?
No, we are not dealing with science fiction, Commander.
Simmer gestured expansively with his cigarette.
Their dental records will match our dental records. Certain injuries, your chronic knee dislocation, for example, and the scar tissue built up because of it, will match. No one has performed plastic surgery to make a facial double quite impossible, to be thoroughly convincing at any event.
And because they think you and I will be dead...
They themselves will die. Then you will resurface and Kuranami and his wife will be killed and the blame will be put on me. You will proclaim your anti-Nazi sentiments and assume the leadership, carrying out my programs ostensibly as a means of making Eden stronger, which indeed will be the case.
And Dread?
Oh, you must overcome your preoccupation with holding the power to destroy the planet, Commander. I control Dread. To use nuclear weapons at this juncture would mean the end of all humanity. But in the future, the threat and judicious use of nuclear weapons backing a conventional force of considerable capability, with appropriate leadership, of course, will be a different story entirely. Consider yourself the interim government for a power which will one day realize man's oldest dream, the domination of the entire planet under one man.
Who?
That is a very intelligent question, Commander. Very incisive. You will not live to know the answer, although I sincerely hope you live to a very old age. No, that is one secret you will not know.
But you are older than I am.
For the moment. Only for the moment, Commander.
Thank you.
It was Natalia's first return to Eden since Dodd branded her an outlaw. And even though many months had passed since Akira Kuranami rescinded that declaration, Natalia harbored no desire ever to return. Too many memories, many of them bad. But the current necessity was inarguable. The people of Eden had once been ready to hang her. Natalia stepped from the J7V, Annie a tread above her. Akira and Elaine stood before the population of Eden as they cheered Natalia's return, along with Annie's. Paul and Michael, who recently picked up a Nazi prisoner in the wastelands, would be arriving soon as well. Natalia turned back to Annie.
Except for Akira and Elaine, they're all hypocrites.
Annie squeezed her shoulder. Michael now sported a mustache. He bore more than a striking resemblance to Natalia's favorite American film star before the night of the war, Tom Selleck. Michael's mustache accentuated the cragginess of his face. He looked older, yet more handsome, different. She imagined what it would be like if Michael smiled, and she hoped he wouldn't.
These the ones?
Michael touched Natalia's arm, but addressed the question to the young German military doctor, Belzer, who supervised the field morgue.
Yes, Herr Rourke.
Michael nodded. Natalia watched his eyes as he looked away from the doctor and back at her, and then at Paul and Annie. Natalia shivered, drawing her coat more closely around her. They were inside the German base outside Eden. The German doctor drew back the hook and pile closed flap, and beneath the black synth rubber, there was a face that was barely human. The shape of the head generally matched that of Commander Dodd, she supposed. Natalia wanted to look away, but would not allow herself the luxury.
We have checked all the dental records, Herr Rourke, but in the case of such men, dental records were not enough. The American Dodd had several times dislocated his knee, the right one. Logic infers there would have been considerable scar tissue and cartilage. We found both in the postmortem. An appendix scar, such as was common before the advent of modern surgical techniques, was also expected to be present. I had never seen one before, of course, but consulted with medical records at New Germany. And, of course, I verified surgically during the postmortem. The appendix is missing. Other small scars on the body, as noted in his records, were all present as they should be. The general shape of his bone structure, his musculature, all matches. I am confident this is the corpse of Commander Dodd.
What about fingerprints?
We checked, of course, and they match. But fingerprints of themselves are not a valid technique for identification, Frau Rubinstein. With current techniques, they can be altered comparatively easily. There is a type of laser surgery on cloned human tissue. Where new fingerprints are grown and the old skin at the fingertips is merely removed, the new skin grafted in place, giving a new fingerprint again, a laser technique. If performed correctly, the procedure leaves no discernible scars.
What about the other body?
Ah, a much more positive identification, Herr Rubinstein.
The young doctor let the flap of the body bag fall back over the charred face of Commander Dodd, then pulled open the next body drawer. Natalia's breath steamed, and for some reason, that at once thrilled and frightened her. She wanted Michael's arm around her. She forced herself to stare at the next body as the doctor pulled open the flap of the bag and drew it back. The face, only half burned, was much more recognizably human and matched photographs of Zimmer. Annie, who saw Zimmer in the flesh, stood riveted.
My God, that's him.
Indeed it is, Frau Rubinstein. We were able to check his retinal print, something unavailable in the case of Commander Dodd. As you can see, one eye was destroyed, the right, but the left is intact. Even with the most sophisticated techniques, retinal identification cannot be... what is the word?
Faked?
Yes, faked, Herr Rourke. This can be no other than Dietrich Zimmer. Body scars, everything matches. DNA typing agrees 100%. As, of course...
He smiled a little condescendingly.
...to the fingerprints.
So they just fell out of the sky? This is almost too convenient.
The report is considerably detailed, Herr Rourke. But in summary, as I understand, President Kuranami had ordered the arrest of Commander Dodd for expropriation of strategic materials. Commander Dodd fled, and Dr. Zimmer was aiding in the commander's escape. Their gunship developed mechanical difficulties of some sort, and there was an explosion. These bodies, as you may already know, were assembled from parts. I was at the scene of the crash. Finding the sufficient number of teeth in order to check dental records was challenging in the extreme. Herr Dr. Simmer's head, for example.
Dr. Belzer drew back the bag farther. Natalia looked away in disgust. There was a difference between doing it in combat and watching it afterward, the clinical thing about it coldly frightening. Dietrich Zimmer's head rested over the shoulders where it belonged, but it was not attached to the body. Natalia stood alone, apart from Michael, Annie, and Paul. The morgue set up to store the bodies was a small prefab building at the far end of the German base's airfield. The wind blew strong here. Natalia was cold. She felt hollow. It was all over. Vengeance, an empty vengeance, was finally theirs. Yet no vengeance could compensate for the loss of John and Sarah and the baby.
Yes, of course. Women only glisten, never sweat.
After helping with moving chairs, painting scenery, and washing dirty children all day long, the moisture on her body was nothing more or less than sweat.
All right, how many of you want to be shepherds?
Not one of them raised a hand.
What's a more or less atheist doing casting a Christmas pageant?
But that really wasn't true. She'd once been an atheist, simply because everyone around her was. But she was one no more. After Natalia saw the bodies of Dodd and Zimmer buried, she left Eden, telling herself she would never return. By the grace of Colonel Mann's J-7V, she flew to Lidveldet Island with Paul and Annie. She stayed with them for several weeks, and while she was at it, studied Christianity under one of the country's many clerics. It was a way to pass the time and focus her mind on something else. And religion, Christianity and Judaism, hadn't seemed to have hurt the only real friend she ever had. In the end, Natalia said goodbye to Paul and Annie and told them to contact her in Europe as soon as Annie was pregnant. Natalia had herself baptized, but not without realizing there was never going to be any philosophy, religious or secular, that she would ever fully embrace, any but her own. Nor did she intend to conduct her life in any manner other than the way in which she conducted it ever since she abandoned the KGB and joined the Rourke family in the fight for freedom. She didn't delude herself that now, somehow, she would have a better chance of prayer being heard. She was convinced some entity heard her prayers, but not that the likelihood of being heard was at all enhanced by water and the sign of the cross, only by the sincerity of one's intent. If God was love, then God, unlike men, could not turn a deaf ear simply out of dislike for the petitioner. She prayed, whenever she thought to do so, however, for John and Sarah to recover. Sometimes she prayed she would be able to ignore the feelings that stirred within her every time she thought of Michael Rourke. He was beautiful and wonderful. John intended that she marry him, that was obvious. But John loved her, that was implicit. She loved John and, God help her, she prayed, she loved Michael. Working with the children of the wild tribes was her only chance for salvation and atonement as well. If there was a hell, she had already consigned herself to it. But that was no excuse to continue along a path she knew was wrong. Nothing could ever undo the evil she did in the name of her native land. And she never prayed to God for herself. Begging was not in her nature, at least not begging for herself. Two ministers from Lidveldet Island and one from Midwake took up residence in what was called Gaul, roughly the location of pre-war Strasbourg, France, along the German border. They helped her with the school and managed the hospital. The man from Midwake was a retired Navy doctor, and she, in turn, offered to help them with this nativity play. Natalia fancied the wise men differently. Women in those days were bond servants and nothing more. But were she a man, and in company of the three wise men from the East, she would have killed Herod and been done with it. It should have been obvious. The man was so obsessed with power that killing the holy child or any child would not bother him one iota. The wise men, however, like most true intellectuals, were innocents in the ways of the world.
I think I would have been a good avenging angel, as long as heaven supplied a Balisong knife. If no one wants to be a shepherd, then who wants to be an angel?
The little girl named Charity, so named by the Reverend Slaughter of Midwake, raised her little hand. Charity, like all of the Wild Tribe's children to greater and lesser degrees, had a face that was distorted by normal standards. Her nostrils flared so wide the nose seemed flat. Her teeth grew larger than they should in normal human children. Her café au lait colored skin looked and felt leathery. But when she smiled, her eyes shone blue and beautiful. At first, Natalia saw the children of the Wild Tribes as ugly. Now she saw them only as children. And as children, they were beautiful and unique. Natalia recalled a verse she remembered from her reading of the Bible about the sins of the fathers being visited upon the children. The ancestors of the Wild Tribes' children planned for nuclear holocaust, but not well enough. Some were French, some German, some Austrian. None prepared or equipped sufficiently well to survive underground long enough. The fathers returned to the surface when the radiation was still too strong. Their descendants paid for those sins with leathery skin, distorted faces, distended teeth, the occasional missing or extra digit, and a heritage of violence that nearly wiped them from the planet. So far, 2,800 members of the Wild Tribes of Europe, as they were called collectively, had been found. 705 of them lived and learned how to live better here at Strasbourg. 183 of the tribes were children, some of them teenagers, some of them infants. Of the remaining 72, her children, none wanted to be shepherds, and one wanted to be an angel.
All right, you are an angel.
Thank you, Natalia.
Before Natalia could stop her, Charity ran up to her and threw her arms so tightly around Natalia's thighs that she nearly lost her balance.
I love you.
Natalia dropped to her knees and hugged Charity.
I love you too.
And I love you, I finally realized.
Natalia stood up. Charity clung to Natalia's skirt. Natalia looked over her shoulder, then closed her eyes. The shoulders of his parka still spotted with snow, hair tousled, wonderful. It was Michael Rourke, and Natalia wondered if Charity were clutching at her knees again or if her knees just stopped working.
That's the way it always is. Never can get a shepherd when you need one.
Why did you come here?
Michael sat on the sofa. He obscured it, she thought, his legs so long, his shoulders so broad. He lit a cigarette, but he didn't answer her. Natalia's prefab was as personalized as she could make it, but when she looked around it, nothing even looked familiar, certainly not inviting. She poured a glass of the German taste-alike for Seagram 7 Crown, John's favorite alcoholic beverage, one of her favorites, too. Michael was at her side.
You should not have come here.
Why?
This can't be.
What if my father never wakes up? And what if he does? He has a wife. I don't. I came to correct that.
You...
Me... what?
No, it's...
Michael reached out and covered her hands with his.
I didn't come here to be a look-alike substitute for the genuine article. If you can't accept me as anything else but that, then I'll leave.
She looked up at him across her kitchen counter.
You don't know what you are asking, Michael.
Oh... yes, I do. I'm asking you to love me.
She bit her lower lip. She swallowed, and she had nothing to swallow. She took a gulp of her whiskey, and it burned her throat, drinking it so fast. She turned her back to him, stabbing her trembling hands into the pockets of her skirt.
I already... Oh, shut up, Natalia.
He must have walked around the counter because she felt hands, strong hands, touching her waist, the fingers almost encircling her.
Let go of me, Michael.
No.
His hands were on her shoulders, and he turned her around. She turned her face away, but then his hands were on her face, lifting her face to his. His eyes, everything about him, his father, not his father. Tears started in her eyes.
Can't you see?
Maybe. Maybe I see something else.
He didn't kiss her, just held her face, and she couldn't stop him. Her arms were at her sides, limp, useless. She lowered her eyes.
I thought about you. I never stopped thinking about you. You were my friend. You still are my friend. I don't know a lot about things like this. Madison was an angel, like your little girl, Charity. I don't love Madison any less, but what I feel for you, I've never felt for anybody.
She shook her head.
This is wrong, Michael. It's wrong for us.
Life? Living? That's wrong?
Michael, I beg you.
No. Tell me to go away, and I'll never be back. That's my promise. Look at me and tell me that, Natalia. Just look at me and say it. That's all you have to do, and it's all over forever.
Natalia Anastasia Temerovna opened her eyes and looked up at Michael Rourke. She opened her mouth and couldn't say it. Michael kissed her, and Natalia melted against his body. She knew what death was in that instant, and life, too. Natalia stood trembling as Michael kissed her. She had pictured this, and like a nightmare, it terrified her.
Will I steal this moment from Michael by thinking of John?
But that did not happen. Michael opened her blouse, pushed it down along her arms, leaving her arms bound within the fabric. He undid the hook and eye fasteners at the back of her bra, the bra sliding down, and she did not move. When she looked into his eyes, touched her lips softly to his face, it was Michael, and there was no dark fantasy within her that it was John. Michael unzipped her skirt, let it fall to the floor. He pushed her slip and her panties over her hips and along her thighs and down to encircle her bare feet. Michael lifted her up into his arms and carried her across the room.
Tell me you love me, Michael.
I love you.
Michael set her down on the bed. Then he was naked beside her, freeing her arms of her clothes, freeing her heart.
I love you, Michael. I love you.
Mr. Rubenstein?
Paul Rubenstein turned around to look for the source of the voice behind him on the path through the park. The face, which went with the voice, was open and smiling, blonde and fair. Stig was a sincere student of history, if not the most naturally gifted.
Yeah? I was wondering, sir, if I might walk with you a bit and ask you a few questions concerning today's lecture, please?
Stig's English was a bit peculiar, but vastly better than Paul Rubenstein's Icelandic.
Certainly. May as well cross the park together. What is it you want to know?
Young Stig fell in at Paul's left side. However long Paul Rubenstein might live with his wife in the rebuilding Hecla community, he knew he would never quite lose the old habits. Paul kept the boy on his left, so if it came to that, he could shove the boy back with his left hand long enough to get at the battered old Browning high power, which he still wore under his coat, and probably always would. He supposed a psychiatrist would call it paranoia, because nothing here in Lidveldet Island posed even the remotest threat. But he remembered how, on a path like this, before the volcano erupted and destroyed everything, before the rebuilding of the Hecla community began, death came to a beautiful, very pregnant young girl named Madison Rourke, Michael's wife. Paranoia or not, Paul Rubenstein would never risk his own fate or the fate of a loved one by going unarmed.
I was wondered, sir.
Wondering? You were wondering, not wondered, okay?
Yes, thank you. No matter how hard I understand or try to understand, I mean, with men such as yourself and Dr. Rourke alive, it is incomprehensible to me that evil flourished so that the war could ever start.
Paul smiled, looking down at his shoes for a moment, then over at young Stig.
I believe you just gave me a very great compliment. So, I thank you for that. Before the night of the war, like everybody else, I was so busy with having a normal life that I thought anyone who planned for something I personally thought was impossible was a little crazy. I really did think that way, Stig. It was my job, my friends, a girl I was going with, the rush to the office every morning, the rush home every night. Not much time to sit down and think about what the world around me was really like, as opposed to what it seemed to me to be. And John Rourke, saw life differently. He was always on the edge, I suppose. He looked beneath the surface and he saw things that most people refused to see. Things some people even refused to see after the war came. It was a much larger world then. Yeah, more people, of course. So many nations. Most people, myself included, couldn't have told you how many. Everything appeared ordered and neat on the surface as it boiled away beneath the surface. People chose never to look below the surface.
I still do not...
Paul shrugged his shoulders.
We were so concerned with getting to work on time, with taxes. Remember I mentioned the concept?
Yes.
Work, taxes, who said what to whom, trying to make money. Anyway, all the little things that had nothing to do at all with really living took up so much time, people found no time for living. The more you value life, the more you try to preserve it. People were too busy to know what life was. Many of them, anyway. Maybe most of them. So the thought of preserving it, if it ever entered into their heads at all, was something to be shunted off to the police or the military or anybody else but themselves. The city I lived in was called New York. More people lived in New York then than on the entire planet today. People put up bars like a prison might just to keep people from breaking into their homes and businesses and hurting them. People wouldn't go out like this at night because there were gangs that would attack people for no reason at all except to steal from them, or maybe just to get some pleasure out of hurting them. If somebody tried to safeguard his own life or the life of a loved one with a weapon of any kind, well, he was violating the law, usually. Life was upside down. Foreign dictators stole from their countries and tortured and killed their own people. The cost of goods and services went up and up. Some people worked harder and harder just to stay even. Others refused to work, expected the government to pay for their livelihood, and raised their children to be the same way. And people hated others because of the color of their skin, or the way they worship God, or because they didn't believe in God, or because they did. Women might do the same work as men, but oftentimes they were paid less. The world was a lot less concerned about right and wrong than about profit and loss. And many laughed at the concept of personal honor, honesty. Still, the majority of the people, like the people today, were good, but basically uninvolved. Too busy living what passed for life to realize that life was passing them by. That even what passed for life might slip through their fingers.
It sounds like hell.
Well, it wasn't. But men like Dr. John Rourke were few and far between. One didn't come along every day. And when they did, people were too busy to listen, let alone do something. The coming of the war was easy.
The Russians must have been terrible people.
Nah. The Russians were just people, not terrible or otherwise. The problem wasn't a problem between freedom and totalitarianism, or good and evil, or anything that simple. The problem was that people were just too busy to care, or too beaten down to do anything if they did care. The world slipped away, and we were all too busy to notice.
They reached the end of the path. About a city block away lay the small house Paul and Annie called home. There were still only two of them, but someday they would have a baby. Just not lucky yet.
I have to leave you here, Stig. Try that book I suggested for Midwake. There's some copies at the library. If the library is out, call me and make arrangements to borrow mine. The author, as I told you, who survived the war, was an American submarine commander. He was closer to the situation than good historical scholarship allows, but the account is the best you'll find.
Thank you, sir. Very much, sir.
Young Stig offered his hand. Paul Rubinstein took it, then turned off the path and along the row of small private houses toward his. As he halved the distance, he saw Annie emerge onto the porch. She raised her right arm and waved at him. Paul waved back, quickening his step. She was beautiful, as always, like a pretty gift wrapped in lace and ribbons, always his. The trappings of life, as he suggested to young Stig, were tempting. As he walked, Paul thought of his friend, John Rourke. If, or when, John awoke in some future time, his friend would be totally alone in a world totally changed. Paul stopped at the base of the porch steps, looking up at Annie in her ankle-length floral print dress and white pinafore-style apron. She looked as delicate as a flower, more beautiful than any flower could be. She loved the everyday things of life, this house, the prospect of a child, the classes she taught, the classes he taught, the normalcy of waiting for him on the front porch every night while dinner cooked on the kitchen stove and the hot bread or a cake or a pie baked in the oven. He felt his waistline. He kept fit, and the good life wasn't showing on him, or at least not yet.
I was thinking about your dad.
I was thinking about him, too, today.
I was wondering if maybe we should,
She opened her arms and he walked up the steps, stopping a few treads below her, folding her into his arms, leaning his head against her breast, holding her, feeling her warmth against his hands, against his face.
Do you want me to say it, Paul?
He didn't move his head. He just hugged her.
Read me?
I didn't mean to. Honest.
Well, to my unasked question, then.
He'd be so alone, especially if Mom...
Paul nodded, touched his lips to her hand as her fingers caressed his cheek. He loved the normalcy, too. But perhaps there really was fate or destiny, and theirs was so inextricably tied to John Rourke's that the bonds could not be broken if they tried. Spring would be very short, of course, because summer was very short, and autumn was even shorter. But winter endured. Within the last few days only, it seemed to relinquish its grip in Gaul and the areas surrounding Strasbourg. The days a little warmer, green sprouting where snow melted. But here, in the distance, it was always winter, because the ice sheet, the glacier, had not retreated more than an inch or so each summer for more than 3 centuries, according to the records. Lidveldet Island was not called the Land of Ice without reason.
Hold my hand!
Michael turned in the pilot's seat and looked at Natalia. He needed only one hand for the controls of the J-7V at the moment, and Natalia, a better pilot than he, knew that. He took her hand in his.
Relax. There's nothing to worry about. Weren't they happy for us?
Yes. When you told them, though, I think I was more frightened than I've ever been in my life.
Why?
The ocean slipped away beneath them, the rocky beach and ice field beyond replacing it. The German base outside Hecla would not be coming up on his heads-up display for another 2 minutes at their present airspeed.
Russians are very strange people, Michael. We feel guilty for everything. That's why there was always so much alcoholism in the Soviet Union, I think. Depression.
Guess I'm a little uptight, too. When I was a kid, I watched you in your chamber. Always beautiful, never stirring. Despite the fact that my childhood wasn't quite normal, you'll have to admit. I still remembered the stories Mom or Dad read to me when I was little. I couldn't look at you without thinking of Sleeping Beauty, but you hadn't eaten something that poisoned you, and as much as I would have loved to awaken you with a kiss like in the story, I thought I knew, that somehow Dad had a wife waiting for me when I grew up.
Michael let go of her hand, the heads-up showing the outer boundary beacon for the base. He started running a pre-landing computer check.
I figured Dad had it all figured out wrong, though. Just picture yourself as a guy in his teens.
I can't.
He squeezed her hand for an instant.
Actually, I can't picture you that way either. Nope, not gonna go there. But what I mean, well, there's this imaging goddess waiting for you to grow up and be old enough to, well, old enough. And you know, that's what your dad had planned all along, but you figure it'll never happen. So I told myself it wouldn't.
If John, your father, if...
Michael looked at Natalia. He nodded.
I hope to God I would have, and you would have.
He picked up the microphone, he hated headsets, and started to call the German base. The kitchen table was typical Annie, Michael thought. Little salt and pepper shakers stood in the middle. Pretty cloth napkins that matched the tablecloth lay on each plate. Fresh flowers stood not just in a vase, but arranged with obvious care. Paul brought him a drink and sat down opposite him.
To whatever.
Good toast.
Michael nodded, clinking glasses, then sipped his wine. Michael's eyes drifted toward the opposite end of the long, narrow kitchen, where Natalia helped Annie. Annie was in a long dress and an apron, looking like a 19th-century doll he'd seen in books. Natalia looked considerably less formal and slightly perplexed.
You look good for yourself, Michael. Natalia does, too. You seem to agree with each other.
Michael Rourke looked at his brother-in-law and friend.
I could say the same for you guys. Annie looks happier than I've ever seen her.
I still can't figure out what she sees in me.
Paul grinned.
She even cooks kosher better than my mother did, God love her. I'm not implying the opposite, but you don't look like you're starving.
He'll eat anything.
This woman does not lie. Seriously, she's a terrific cook. I asked her once, you know, to make something Russian. She said she never learned how to cook Russian food.
When I was on that job with Vladimir.
Natalia looked toward them over the half-open oven door.
Where we had to pretend to be Americans? I needed to know how to cook, so the KGB sent me to a cooking school. All they taught was American and continental cuisine, so I never learned how to cook like a Russian.
I had an aunt who was Russian. Trust me, if she was any indicator of Russian cooking.
No!
Natalia stood, her potholdered hands clasped to a pie.
Russian cooking can be wonderful. I just never learned it.
Michael pulled out his father's lighter and pushed it toward Paul. Paul picked up the battered Zippo and turned it over in his hand.
J.T.R. Wow.
Paul put the lighter down.
Tell him, Paul.
Michael looked at Paul.
Tell me what?
I figured to talk about it later, but I may as well talk about it now. Annie and I have been giving this a lot of thought, careful consideration.
You're going to join them.
Paul looked at Annie, then back at Michael.
Yeah, I checked it all out. Yeah, we decided. Him, anyway. Someday he'll come out of the coma he's in, and Sarah, they still say it'll take a medical breakthrough that they can't foresee to give her even a chance, but someday he'll come out of it. The monitoring system showed that with his brainwave patterns. I talked to Dr. Munchen. They've done some experiments, and they're certain. There shouldn't be any trouble telling when his alpha rhythms get to normal range. Your dad'll be,
alone.
Yeah. So, you and Natalia have each other now. He would have wanted that. We can tell him all about you guys and everything.
When I radioed, I said we had something special to tell you.
Yeah, I figured maybe you guys were getting married, maybe,
We were going to tell you the same thing, Paul. Natalia and I talked about it a lot, and we came up with a lot of reasons. I don't know how good any of them are, but it's something we want to do. I haven't checked with Dr. Munchen or anything, but he was next on my list. We figured, Natalia and I, that we wanted to tell Dad ourselves, be there when he wakes up, maybe find a way that doesn't exist yet to help Mom.
Paul extended his hand.
The family.
Sarah Rourke wore a bandage over her left temple, yet in her sleep, she looked beautiful, forever at peace. Michael looked at Paul, then at Annie. They were already asleep, the blue-white gas suffused throughout their chambers. Consciousness of his nakedness only a fleeting thought, he walked barefoot across the warm metal floor to where Natalia sat, covered only in a sheet from her breasts to her toes. She smiled.
When you went into this sleep, I gave you and Annie the injections. How things have changed, but remain the same. You were the most beautiful little boy, and now...
Michael leaned close to her, touching his lips to hers.
Lovers, when we awaken, I'll love you then as I love you now.
Natalia put her head against his chest, her lips touching his flesh, her arms clutched around him. She trembled slightly. After a moment that was not long enough, he helped her into her chamber, helping her with the light sheet to cover her. Dr. Munchen approached.
Are you ready, Natalia?
Natalia looked at Michael.
She's ready.
Natalia smiled, then closed her eyes. Dr. Munchen sprayed her arm with the antiseptic, then touched the needle to her skin. Michael held her hand for a while longer, then looked at Munchen. Michael nodded. The cryogenic chamber closed, and Michael stepped away, going to his own. He sat on the edge. When he looked to his right, above his own chamber, he could see his father, when the gas swirled for an instant quite clearly.
So, Michael, I will never see you again. But do a kindness for me.
Michael looked at Munchen's eyes.
Of course.
Good. Tell someone about me, that is all. That way, long after I am dead, I will know I am remembered.
Michael extended his hand to Munchen, and Munchen smiled and took his hand.
So, shall we?
Michael turned, brought up his legs, then stretched out in the chamber. The German models were more spacious, better designed to guard against blood clotting by suspending the sleeper. The spray was cool against his arm. He looked at Munchen, then at Natalia, the gas already all but obscuring her. Then Michael closed his eyes.
I'll remember you as a friend.
Kurenami was in power in Eden. Dodd and Zimmer were dead. The new world was a place of promise, the future bright. The needle touched his skin, pricked his flesh. Michael Rourke remembered that one dreamed in the sleep, dreamed endlessly. So he focused his mind on Natalia and the love they shared, in the hope that his dreams would be good ones. The hem of the pretty girl's sleeveless white mini-dress stopped well above the midpoint between hip and knee. She wore a soft white cap with a bill on it over her past shoulder-length straight blonde hair. Over her textured white stockings, her feet were clad in knee-high white plastic boots with large industrial-sized zippers running up the sides, the same as the zipper at the front of her dress.
Now, everyone aboard the bus, please, and mind your step!
She looked over the rims of her big round sunglasses and smiled.
Remember, citizens of Eden and any foreign visitors, Retreat Tours, its employees and subsidiaries, cannot be responsible for any lost articles. So keep your belongings with you in hand at all times.
He had no possessions in hand. Stepped aside to allow a woman with a small child in tow to board ahead of him, then climbed aboard himself. The bus was jointed at the center, and after a hurried guesstimate, he judged it would carry 100 people. He took a seat near the center exit door and beside a window on the driver's side. The center rows were filling up fast, and most of the window seats were taken. A girl, dressed and coiffed similarly to the tour guide, but with a different color scheme, brown hair, a blue dress, and blue boots, sat down beside him. She wore round-framed glasses, too, but not for sun, and had pretty green eyes behind them.
You can have the window seat if you like.
No, I like to be able to move around, but thanks anyway. Taken the tour to Rourke's retreat before?
No, I've never taken the tour. Is it exciting?
Oh, I guess if you like history and everything.
Don't you like history?
I'm taking a group of sixth graders here next week as part of Rourke Day celebrations. I haven't been in years, so I figured I'd go up and have a look around. So the kids think I know what I'm talking about. If you haven't been, give this a read.
She reached into her smallest shoulder bag and took out a folded-up brochure. She offered it, and he took it. There was a pretty color photograph of a rather heroically posed statue atop a mountain summit.
That is a nice piece of sculpture, isn't it?
She was looking over his shoulder.
You know the story, of course, right?
Well, I know about John Rourke, of course, but all this, the retreat towards, it's all new to me. History wasn't my big subject either.
Golly, hard to imagine anybody not knowing it.
She shrugged her little shoulders.
That's supposed to be John Rourke. How he looked when he single-handedly fought off the last Soviet helicopter on the morning of the Great Conflagration. That's the old American flag supposed to be flying behind him there, see?
Yeah, marvelous detail in the sculpture.
He was a pretty handsome guy, the way they depict him anyway. When I was a little girl, I used to look at his face on the dollar bill and think, wow, what a guy. Mom and Dad were into history, so I guess that's where I got it.
The retreat was his personal hideaway.
Got all his stuff there, or most of it, anyway. The guns they display there, you'll like that part, most men do. They're supposed to be the same guns he really used before he was killed in that hospital explosion.
I thought they survived that.
Well, I suppose you can look at it that way, but both of them were brain dead anyway. Poor people. But you're right, technically. They were still alive until those terrorists attacked the place at Midway where their bodies were being kept and burned.
Now, was that before or after Kurenami and his wife were assassinated?
The same day. Let me guess, you're from Midway, right?
I've spent a lot of time there.
Yeah, can you imagine that? John and Sarah Rourke were both killed. Actually killed. And the first president of Eden and his wife were assassinated on the same day. Gosh, that would have been a recreationist's nightmare, wouldn't it?
Recreationist?
No, come on, they've got to use recreationists at Midway.
I don't think so, but if you tell me what one is, I can tell you for sure.
The bus started.
Please make certain your seatbelts are properly fastened. The road leading up to Rourke's Mountain is very steep. For safety information, consult the monitors and the seat backs in front of you.
What was I saying?
He looked at the girl and smiled.
You were telling me what a recreationist is?
Oh, well, you know, on the news, when there's a crime or something, it's reenacted so people can see how it actually took place.
Like a play?
Well, sort of. But nobody makes it up. It's just like the real thing, only better.
I see. How long have you been teaching sixth graders?
5 years. I taught kindergarten for a year before that.
It must be wonderful to be a teacher.
It's a living.
In this, the 125th year since the landing of the Eden Fleet, every citizen of Eden, every citizen of the world, should pause to reflect on the courage of Dr. John Thomas Rourke.
Automatically, it seemed, the windows of the bus tinted, obscuring exterior light. There was a flicker on the video screen in the seat back in front of him. An intricate electronic logo appeared for Eden National Television. The logo faded to the statue shown on the brochure the young woman showed him, but it was a close-up of the statue's face. The camera drew back, starting to pan around the statue.
125 years ago, this man, Dr. John Thomas Rourke, risked his life to save the returning Eden Project astronauts. The world was still engaged in the bloodiest war of human history, a war that destroyed almost all life on the planet. Under John Rourke's leadership, and with the help of the courageous Eden astronauts, a fighting force was forged, standing virtually alone against the land, naval, and air forces of the Soviet Union.
He recalled the line variously attributed to several historical figures, among them Napoleon. History is a set of lies agreed upon.
They say that Lance Stone almost begged the government to let him play John Rourke. Isn't Lance Stone just gorgeous?
The actor, tall, with dark curly hair, stood atop a mountain, shirt ripped to shreds, corded muscles rippling beneath the tatters. He held a pistol in each hand. The American flag blew in a stiff wind behind him. Fire rolled across the sky, chasing helicopter gunships, all painted matte black, miniguns firing. Smoky white contrails snaked behind streaking red-tipped missiles. The man imagined this was a very sophisticated form of digitized computer animation. The image cut back to Lance Stone.
You haven't won, Karamazov, and as long as one free person exists on this scorched planet, you never will. Come and get me!
It should have been Rozhdestvenskaya to whom the actor hurled his challenge, because at the time, Karamazov was assumed dead. The helicopter streaked over the mountainside, and Lance Stone, as John Rourke, oiled muscles rippling, flag still flowing in the breeze behind him, fired his pistols from the hip. One of the Soviet helicopter gunships exploded in midair, fiery bodies tumbling from it. The image cut back to the sky as fire rolled in from all directions. Close-up of Lance Stone as John Rourke. Somehow he got a cigar in his mouth, a big one, half-smoked. And the way the camera and the lighting worked together, his eyes could be seen faintly behind dark-lensed aviator-style sunglasses, squinting in determination as lightning bolts flashed all around him and machine gun fire barely missed him. The image cut back to the continuing pan of the statue.
With the help of his faithful companion, Paul Rubinstein, John Rourke's heroism saw its finest hour when Soviet gunships attempted to shoot the returning Eden Project spacecraft from the skies.
His eyes never left the screen. While walking beside the young teacher up the path to the retreat, he listened to the tour narrative on earbuds.
The historical importance of the Rourke Shrine cannot be minimized. It was here, at the retreat, that John Rourke set his plans to save the world. Now on Eden-owned land, the retreat on Rourke's Mountain is a modern-day mecca for citizens of Eden and citizens of the world. On the very same day as the terrorist assault on the repository at Midwake, where the Rourke family bodies were held in cryogenic freeze, Eden's first president, the courageous Japanese astronaut Akiro Kuranami, was assassinated along with his wife, the former Elaine Halverson, an Eden scientist. Commander Christopher Dodd, once believed the victim of foul play, was miraculously alive. Dodd returned in the aftermath of President Kuranami's death and heroically assumed the mantle of leadership he rejected months earlier when he refused to run for the presidency. Christopher Dodd, against his protestations, continued as president of Eden until his death, at which time a successor he himself selected was voted unanimously into office by the ever-growing Eden population. That man, of course, Eden's third president, was Arthur.
He wasn't interested, but there was no way of shutting off the wireless headphones, so he ignored the words. Thankfully, as they reached the height of the road, the broadcast ceased. Others removed their headphones, and so did he.
You know, you look familiar.
I do? Well, I guess I just have that sort of face. Common.
No, you have a nice face. And I don't usually like beards.
He smiled.
What are you doing after the tour?
He looked at her.
I'm sorry?
Do you have a health card?
He had to think.
Yes.
Well, why not come to my place and we can see what develops over the evening, huh? I've got a spare toothbrush.
He tried thinking of an answer.
All right. May I have your attention, please? We are about to enter the retreat. This entrance before you was once a closely guarded secret, known only to Dr. Rourke's closest friends, men like Akira Kuranami and Christopher Dodd.
Half right.
These synth glass electronic doors weren't in use then. Now remember, inside the retreat are real weapons, vastly more powerful than some that are in use by the outlaws in the wildlands. They are all under unbreakable synth glass, but please remember not to touch anything.
People started filing through.